We should have solar panels on all kinds of construction vehicles and garbage trucks that are out in the sun all day and could just be collecting energy and fueling themselves. We could do all sorts of things like street cleaning and garbage collecting using bike-powered vehicles. There's so much space to just be doing things differently in ways that don't use our traditional means for doing them, and where you can still reemploy people who are in those industries, where you can use a lot of the assets and infrastructure. You know, there are 101 ideas you could come up with on any given week that probably aren't that hard to do if you could get the right partners in place and just start to do it on a small scale.
Welcome to Cross Pollination, episode 15. We're a member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. You're listening to Cross Pollination, where we're here to plant familiar ideas in new soil. Our guests are original, creative, and bold. They've typically done something differently from other people in their fields and gotten interesting, sometimes unexpected results. I'm NB. I'll be your host. This week, Cross Pollination talks to Alicia Muscat. If you've ever wondered how the down ramps at the edges of city sidewalks came about that allow wheelchairs, strollers, and anything with wheels to descend gently onto the road, you're in good company with Alicia. She spent her career working on social innovation and with social entrepreneurs of different kinds. More recently, she's focused on civic innovation, a secret sauce for cities. Alicia's been in executive leadership roles at Ashoka Canada, Peace Builders International Canada, and the Emerging Leaders Network with Civic Action in Toronto. She's now based near Boston in the U.S., and she believes that right now is a hot time for social innovation. She's keen to tell us why, starting with the opposite end of the scale, when the need for social innovations becomes obsolete.
Sometimes there's some new solution that I really love talking about, and then the world catches up and makes it obsolete in a way that's really positive. Ashoka has thousands of social entrepreneurs as part of its network around the world, and they've been working on their innovations. Ashoka's been around since the early 70s, and so some of these ideas, you know, at this point are 40 or 50 years old. And some of the early stories of innovations that Ashoka was talking about have become obsolete because they've been taken up as sort of the new status quo. So it could have been new ways of providing energy in rural parts of Brazil that was then mandated to be provided. You know, the government mandated that energy companies provide energy access. So in a sense, these early social entrepreneurs were waving the flag saying this needs to happen. And if you're not going to do it, we'll figure out a way to do this. And then you had the larger power say, okay, we understand we need to do this, so we'll provide this service. There was a story I used to love to tell about a woman who was driving a car. She was in a car accident. It was not her fault. The other person was older and maybe shouldn't have had a license anymore. And she almost lost her son in the accident. She had a young son in the car with her, and he survived, but it was close there for a while. And her response was, how do I make sure that people who are getting older and maybe shouldn't be driving anymore have safe ways of getting around and still feeling independent, as opposed to feeling like they need to hold on to their cars? Okay, what a response for a person to have. It wasn't like, this person needs to be off the road. It wasn't a lawsuit. It was, the person who was driving the other car was driving it because they wanted to feel independent. They needed to get around. We don't have public transportation here that's going to allow them to do that. How do I ensure that that can continue to happen, but safely so? So she created this whole network of volunteer drivers, and it really incredible. But now we have Uber and Lyft, right? So you have these new innovations that completely make obsolete these early versions of this kind of work, but it's fabulous. And so I think that's one of the things I find really surprising, is how we can make ideas no longer new and no longer important, but in a sense, because they've laid the groundwork for something that's at scale, and that's usually a market solution.
How many innovators get excited when the need for their innovations goes away? Clearly, social innovation is different from your regular business that wants to innovate, to be competitive, and to get into or stay in the game. Or is that true? Alicia tells us what social innovation is all about.
It really is about creating something new, about looking at a problem and tackling it from a different angle, by redefining it, by looking at the causes of the underlying symptoms or underlying the problems, and by redefining that, you can unlock all sorts of new ways of addressing and approaching that. But instead of creating a new market to make money or to access new customers or creating a new product, you're creating something that's going to make society operate better. So it may be looking at public infrastructure, education, health, the natural environment, or you could be looking at innovating around political inclusion or social norms, how we interact with one another. So that's how I like to think about social innovation, is that it's a way of unlocking solutions and applying thinking to create something that's fundamentally new, not small improvements, but that is really new, that addresses the way that we interact in society.
Since one possible area for social innovation is in education, you may be interested in Back to School Again, a podcast hosted by Katrina Ingram, presented by Norquest College. Katrina Ingram hosts the show. She is sponsored by Norquest College and interviews people who've returned to the classroom in midlife. She interchronicles her own journey as an adult who finds herself back in school. You'll also learn about the unique programs at Norquest College that help it provide learning opportunities for all. The podcast comes out every 2 weeks. Read the show notes and subscribe at backtoschoolagain.ca. Social innovation can be pretty radical. It's got a lot in common with business innovations that look at things from a new angle and disrupt the status quo to unlock new value. But it's different in specifically highlighting the social value that gets created, not necessarily economic value. Although social innovations built around a business model like social enterprises do need to make sure they're financially sustainable and stay that way. Here's Alicia on an example of social innovation, Specialistern, an international organization founded in Denmark, now in 13 countries, that leverages the strengths of some people on the autism spectrum.
Instead of saying people on the autism spectrum need support to be able to navigate our workplaces as they currently are, the founder of Specialistern, who has a son with autism, who has some incredible talents that are beyond probably what you or I, well, certainly what I could do, but also has different ways of interacting with people where sarcasm, he doesn't understand sarcasm, his personal interactions are very different from what they might be in a typical workplace. So Torkel Sohn, who created Specialistern, was looking at how can we actually understand that certain industries can actually need the talents of people like his son, and to open up opportunities for people with certain traits on the autism spectrum to be in demand, to be compensated, celebrated, promoted, and to really be a valuable asset in the workplace instead of a population that needs to be accommodated for. Again, it's a different way of thinking about the problem. It's asset-based, and it's creating a form of equity and inclusion in the workplace instead of thinking about it as accommodation.
Flipping the script from talking about good causes and accommodation to one where the same people and organizations are creating value is a game changer and is a hallmark of social innovation. Alicia tells us what first attracted her to the field.
And what initially appealed to me about it was a different way of funding and resourcing and thinking about social change from a typical nonprofit model of going after grants and philanthropic dollars to invest in charity work, in a sense. I was really drawn into the idea of being able to sell the value of the social impact work that you were doing, regardless of how innovative it was, if it was a service that had been delivered for a long time, or if it was a completely new approach, that you were really selling the value as opposed to having people think about how they could donate to it because it was a good cause.
Alicia's noted that grants and philanthropy do have value. Adding a social innovation component, though, changes the equation from a separated donor-recipient model and potentially offers organizations new ways to sustain themselves. Social innovation also uses some of the tools of business with some key considerations and differences in how those innovations get developed.
I do really like all of the ties between innovation and social innovation and entrepreneurship and social entrepreneurship. And in the social innovation and social entrepreneurship world, you see a lot of the same kinds of methodologies applied that you see elsewhere. So the development of an MVP or minimum viable product, you'll see, fail fast and using business model canvases. So we're really using a lot of the industry tools, but applying them in a different way. And one of the things that we have to be aware of when we're developing and innovating within a social context is failing fast has consequences for people that you invite in. So if you're testing out a service model with real people with real needs, and then you say, you know what, that didn't work, we're going to completely pivot, we're going to shift our model, or we're going to pursue a new market, you've now left people without supports that you put in place for a very short-term period of time. So the stakes are higher and the consequences are very different, because you're not just learning from an investment, a financial investment, but you are taking away supports that you've offered to an individual.
One of the ways to mitigate that risk is through processes like co-creation that involve the people who'll be served by a new solution, and which you can hear more about in episode 13, Tackling Problems with Good Design.
I think there's some great models for doing that. So if you are innovating with people who you are serving and they are part of the team that's developing a solution, then you're not sort of reaching out to them and then leaving them. You're including them in the entire process. So that kind of inclusive human-centered design type of process is one really good way of doing that.
Focusing in from social innovation, Alicia eventually came to a particular interest in civic innovation, solving problems in areas that impact cities and the ways that cities work.
So I started to get involved with an organization called Civic Action that's based in Toronto. I was interested in getting involved because I've become increasingly passionate about the role that cities play in our lives. I find that I love the big, new, flashy ideas that come out of innovative thinking. And I also am becoming increasingly fascinated by some of the more mundane, really sort of face-level things that can happen and that need to happen within cities. You know, cities were built a long time ago, most cities, and they were built in service of different populations, different technologies, different activities. So they might have been built for horses and then built for cars. They were built assuming that people were paying attention to their surroundings as opposed to walking around looking at smartphones, built for different times. And we've done a lot to retrofit our cities and to force them to adapt, but they uphold the values and the priorities of the times in which they were built. I think growing up, I thought it would be really exciting to work in the city, and I should give a caveat that I've never worked for municipal government or in operating a city. But I think over time, I started to see, cities and municipalities in some ways are like the superintendents of a building. They're responsible for trash collection and making sure the lights are on, making sure the sidewalks are clear, and we have access to public libraries and some very important things. But they're important because they're in service of creating vibrant and kind and fun and safe and beautiful and wealthy and thriving places to be. So you have this very kind of mundane set of services that you have to provide in order to create these fabulous places for people to live. And there's something about that that is interesting and exciting to me, especially when you look at what social innovation can do in partnership with running a city.
If you're an enthusiastic civic innovator, where do you get started?
You can find a place to do it. If you need to create it yourself, there are fellowships and venture funds and pitch competitions coming out of every side street and main street in every city around the world right now. So if you want to start it yourself, start it yourself. if you want to be in a company and create change from within, there are companies that celebrate entrepreneurs and have that and have a culture that invests in people who want to create that change internally. If you want to just read about it and get inspired, there are so many places to do that. We see it happening in universities and companies and municipalities. So it's really a hot time for social innovation in a way that is notably different from 10 years ago. I came to the world of social entrepreneurship and social innovation in sort of the mid-2000s, and nobody knew what it meant. Nobody had heard these terms. It was all very confusing. And those of us working in this space, I think, were really concerned with defining it and professionalizing it and having an almost academic approach to it, which made it really inaccessible. But I think now it's become so much a part of the world and of professional services and of product development that whatever you want to do to tinker to make something work better, there are opportunities to do it as a full-time gig, as a part-time gig, as a volunteer, as a hobby. Just find the thing that you stay up at night thinking about and learn more about it and start playing around with ideas in your head and start playing around with building something.
Civic innovation has the possibility to include and impact large groups of people in a city.
One of the most important things that cities can do is create a sense of inclusion and belonging for all different types of populations. That can be newcomers. It can be people of different racial backgrounds. It can mean skin color, and I mean that very literally, because talk to people in Toronto, people look all kinds of different ways and identify as being Canadian and from Toronto, but the way that people present physically can change how they interact with the city. And then it can also be in terms of accessibility and mobility devices. You know, I don't know the history of when all of our sidewalks were required to have those dips at the corner that allow you to come off the sidewalk if you're in a wheelchair or pushing a stroller. I will look into that at some point. One of the accessibility issues that our cities continue to have is the sort of one step into a building. So you could have a retail environment, you could have a store or a restaurant, anything that's sort of street level and storefront that is completely accessible, except that you need to get over one step to get into the building or into the front door. So you have an organization like the Stopgap Foundation, which has this very simple solution to that, which is that they build these small wooden ramps. And they are inexpensive, and you can custom design them. They're built by somebody who uses a mobility device and the team that is built around them. And they're really about a whole conversation around inclusion and making spaces more accessible. But this very simple solution of a ramp that you can pick up at the end of the day and you can put down during business hours and that invites people in is, I think, this like fabulous and very simple kind of innovation that integrates with the city that changes the way we invite people into spaces. That's, you know, a privately developed product, but you also need the city to allow you to put a small ramp onto the sidewalk, right? So that kind of municipal regulation sometimes just requires you getting out of the way and saying, yeah, sure, go ahead. You can put a small ramp outside your building because it addresses this greater need.
Another big area for civic innovation has to do with food distribution and food waste.
A similar kind of getting out of the way or reinforcing of an existing policy is around food redistribution. So there are many, many organizations that look at food waste, and it could be prepared foods like leftover meals that come out of restaurant kitchens or that come out of sports stadiums. Or it could be produce that needs to get used, eaten, cooked very quickly because it's about to go bad, and redistributing that to places where people don't have access to good, healthy food. So whether it's Second Harvest or L'Atelier des Chefs, we need our cities and our governments to allow for what's called the Good Samaritan laws, to make it easier for people to move food around without fear of being sued if, let's say, somebody gets food poisoning. You need to relax some of the liability, not to make people less accountable, but to really allow for this greater good of allowing food that is the majority of which is healthy and safe and properly handled and all of that to be redistributed for a huge greater good.
So it's pretty clear a lot of different kinds of civic innovation solutions are possible. I asked Alicia what the ingredients of a good project look like, what and who the participants need to consider.
Partnerships are definitely crucial. I really believe in designing with your stakeholders, with your direct stakeholders and your indirect stakeholders. Again, design with the people who you're aiming to serve. I always love when an innovation comes out of a community itself. So if it's a person who is trying to come up with a solution for their own challenge or one that's in their family or in their community, the more questions, the more skepticism that you have and that you can respond to in the early days, the better. If you think there's someone it's going to be really hard to convince, bring them to the table from the beginning. Get someone who is a willing skeptic to be on your team. Reach out to them. And every time you iterate, every time you pivot, every time you change your value proposition or figure out a new way that you want to try marketing or selling what you're working on, pitch it to them and get their response. While you want skeptics involved, you also want champions involved. You want to serve a particular community, but you may know from the beginning that you want the city to be your customer. So work with the city on what they need. They often have spending plans and policies that they need to create way in advance. You know, they tend to operate fairly slowly because they need a lot of planning. They need to be representing their constituencies. Often they already know what they want to be working on addressing way in advance, but they don't necessarily have the partners in place. And if you can show up early, and if you have a long enough lead time before you need to start earning income, that you can be working and designing with that customer in mind, but also with the values of the community that you're trying to serve front and center, then you're going to develop something that works really well that people are going to be happy with. And you're also going to have the communities around you that will hopefully give you feedback if something isn't working. So if something's too slow, or if it's too expensive, or if it's too risky, or if you've had too many liability issues come up and they're concerned about those, you can be addressing them because you have the right channels of communication open.
Coming back to risks again, especially in talking about recovering and using food that might go bad quickly in city food programs, I wondered how social innovators in the civic space can handle possible concerns about risks related to their projects.
Not always effective, but I do think that when you're talking about social innovation, there's a risk of doing something new, and there's also a risk of not doing something new. Juvenile justice provided a very fertile ground for exploring that because people are very hesitant in the world of justice to explore anything new because it might be changing our ideas about personal accountability. But when you look at things like our recidivism rates, we're already failing. Like, we are really failing in responding to issues around criminal justice. New approaches are very unlikely to fail even worse than our current systems are failing. Okay, so if the food had something in it that was going to make someone sick, that food is already coming out of a restaurant where that's happening, right? And it's going to get caught very quickly. We have great public health departments that can trace these things back to either a bad product or to a problem with the food handling. And the, you know, the risk associated with that is minimized and it's taken very seriously. Whereas somebody showing up to a food shelter of one kind, you know, either a shelter that's providing food or to a food kitchen and not having access to any food or having really bad product there because it's not good quality and it's not healthy, that is risky too. Mm-hmm. So I think part of it is about how you present risk in conversations. I think some of it is really about finding the right champions in, whether it's within city government or within a corporate partnership who just thinks like, yes, obviously this is a fantastic idea, or I think this is good, tell me more, convince me, bring the data, tell the story, show the evidence, and then making your case. But what I love about innovation, regardless of the context, is that usually when it's a really good idea, either people's response is, oh my goodness, that's so obvious, why aren't we doing that already? Or it's, that's so weird, it might work. You know, it tends to be these two extremes. And I think both are really exciting.
That's so obvious to that's so weird. One of the interesting and very practical opportunities in civic innovation is through procurement programs. Alicia outlines here Canadian government programs, and these kinds of programs also exist in many other countries.
So now in Toronto, in Ontario, and in Canada, those three municipal, provincial, and federal levels of government, there are opportunities for social procurement, which, as I mentioned earlier, means purchasing services and products from social enterprises. So that could be like organizations that employ people with barriers to employment. There are courier companies, bike courier and foot courier companies. There are social contractors who do work in buildings, you know, painting and landscaping and things like that. There could be transportation companies. There are companies that provide gardening services. There are all sorts of services that help provide employment opportunities to lots of people. And right now, again, at those three levels of government, there are actually budgets that are set aside specifically to hold contracts with social enterprises. And so if you're somebody who's starting a social enterprise and is providing a product or service like that, you should look into what your government has in place that it's required to do. What do they require of anybody that they're going to be purchasing products or services from? How can you work with them to understand what they're looking for? And how can you access those dollars? Again, building up, you know, we've been able to take advantage of those at all levels of government. And that's provided a huge pipeline of paid work to allow the organization to thrive and to support the people that we train and develop into careers.
There are some amazing initiatives and organizations in this area. But I always want to know about the hard stuff, what they need to have grit to get through. I asked Alicia about some of the most common challenges civic innovators need to overcome.
Sometimes there can be these sort of old and sometimes obsolete and sometimes important barriers that are in place. And even when people don't necessarily want them to be there, it's not easy to change them. So it could be something related to, could be a bylaw, could be a building code. It could be something that requires dollars to be spent in certain ways, or it could be an old contract and you have to wait for that contract to expire before you put something new in place. So I think there are some very structural barriers that can be in place that can make it really challenging to work with cities. Obviously, political will and election cycles can get in the way, and the emergence of anything that happened in a sense in the news cycle. Again, sort of looking back at juvenile justice, anytime there's a shooting that involves young people, that can be a huge setback to moving things forward because it makes people retreat and clam up a bit when they're thinking about new ways of going forward. And again, even though the old ways may not be effective, it makes people nervous and it makes them protective, right? So I think that sometimes it can be way easier to innovate in a space where nobody's paying attention because you can move things forward and you can get some traction, and then people only start to pay attention when you have some success. When it's something that people are watching with a microscope, they're very quick to be critical of what you're doing. But I think on the flip side, there's so much opportunity. Like, I think things like stopgaps and ramps are so easy. You know, another great example of civic innovation, I think, is bike sharing programs. They seem in a way, like I have to say that I'm a person who owns three bicycles. I don't have a car. I ride my bike everywhere I go. And any city I live in or I visit, I'm using their bike share program because sometimes you're out without your bike and you want to use a bike to get around. So even the most redundant seeming thing still has a huge market opportunity there.
If you're interested in starting something, ATB has a cool program called Lender that can help you if you need to find alternative funding ideas. ATB matches what you can raise from a crowd. Check out ATB, LENDR.ca to learn more. Rounding it off with opportunities, that's it for this week's episode on civic and social innovation. If you'd like to connect with Alicia Muscat and her work and what she's interested in doing next, you can find her on Twitter at Alicia Lara. If you'd like to comment on this episode or suggest a future guest, you can find this show at www.crosspollination.co or on Twitter at Pollinata1. In 2 weeks, we'll be back with a new episode on how to cultivate creativity and innovating in organizations. Thanks for listening.